From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The fate of Saddam Hussein is now in the hands of his fellow Iraqis. The former dictator was handed over today to Iraq's interim government. They get legal custody. Saddam remains under American guard. Tomorrow he appears in court to face charges expected to include war crimes. His trial is scheduled to begin within a matter of months. With roughly 30 tons of documents and a wide array of other evidence to sift through, the trial of Saddam Hussein will be a daunting endeavor, but for his victims, today's move is a giant first step. Tonight on Point, putting Saddam Hussein on trial. We begin in Baghdad. Anne Bernard is a correspondent for the Boston Globe, where I asked her how Iraqis were reacting to the handover of the legal custody of Saddam Hussein.
People seem to see this as a symbol of sovereignty. That's certainly the way the Iraqi government wants them to see it. And some have even whispered that the Iraqi government is making this their first major act as a sovereign government, specifically to distract attention from the fact that they can't solve the security problems that are frightening Iraqis day in and day out. Here's something they can do that shows that they're taking control of one of the major legal issues and one of the major issues of reconciliation and justice for the country. So I think there's mixed feelings. I think some people feel that it doesn't really make a difference to their lives, but on the other hand, you can't help but feel that there's a symbolism to taking control of the man that previously had control of them.
And what terms, conditions have been attached to the transfer to Iraqi legal custody of Saddam Hussein?
Conditions? In order for Iraqis to take over physical custody of him, they will have to be ready to guarantee that he won't be able to escape and that he won't be assassinated. So once he's transferred to the legal custody of Iraqis, his status changes in the sense that he loses the protection of the Geneva Conventions. He becomes subject to Iraqi law. But for Saddam Hussein, he actually gains a lot because he now will have the right to a lawyer, and American investigators will not be able to freely question him. Like anybody else, they will have to ask for permission to see him, and he'll be able to have a lawyer with him.
Were Saddam Hussein and the other defendants made aware of this change in their legal status?
I don't know if they were aware of it in advance. They were made aware of it today. We actually met with the spokesman for Prime Minister Alawi today, George Sada, and he said that he had heard from the investigating judge who had brought the warrant for his arrest to Saddam Hussein in person. And we were very tantalized, and we asked what was Saddam's reaction. And the spokesman, George Sada, said, "The judge told me he'll tell me when he sees me in person." So it's a mystery. But Saddam was informed in person about the change in his status and the charges against him.
So when and with what will Saddam be formally charged?
Saddam will be formally charged tomorrow in front of an Iraqi investigative judge. And we haven't been told for sure what the charges will be, but about a month ago, in an interview with my colleague from the Globe, Fanasi Kambanis, Salim Chalabi, the chief administrator of the Iraqi Special Tribunal that will try Saddam and other suspected war criminals, said that the charges are likely to include at least several items from a list of 12 major crimes over the last decade or so. And that includes everything from war crimes against Iran and Kuwait to the suppression of the 1991 rebellion among Shiite Muslims in the South after the Gulf War, to the well-known gas attacks against Kurds in northern Iraq. So they're trying to choose crimes that affected all the disparate groups in Iraq, so that they're broad enough to represent everyone that was hurt by Saddam, but also they can't try him for every single thing he's suspected of. They need to keep a focus so that they have a manageable amount of evidence and witnesses.
Is anybody even talking yet about a date for the trial, particularly with so much continuing insecurity in Iraq?
Well, they have talked about it. A couple of U.S. legal advisors that are working on the case told us yesterday that they're looking at early next year for Saddam. They may charge some other people earlier than that, but they're still working to train the Iraqi investigators, to collect evidence, to sift through millions of pages of documents. And I believe that the tribunal has a rule that people have to be tried within 6 months of being charged. But that gives them a time window to finish their investigation and decide on their strategy, which is not only prosecutorial but political. They have to decide how to focus on the crimes of Saddam without giving him a platform from which to grandstand and increase his popularity.
And do we have any idea how counsel for Saddam Hussein are going to frame their defense?
We're hearing reports that Saddam Hussein's wife has already hired up 20 lawyers to represent him. And one of them was quoted on French radio saying that he would argue that the entire invasion of Iraq was illegal, and so that Saddam has been captured and is being tried on illegal grounds. Other lawyers have suggested that they will call everyone from Donald Rumsfeld to President Bush to argue that Saddam may have had weapons of mass destruction, but who gave them to him? So the attempt will be to turn the charges back on the United States officials that backed Saddam during the days that he was a United States client.
And Bernard, many thanks.
Thank you very much.
And Bernard is a correspondent for the Boston Globe. She spoke to me from Baghdad. We're talking this hour about the fate of Saddam Hussein, his trial and what it means to the Iraqi people. Why is it important for Saddam to have an open and fair trial? Do you believe he'll get one, or will this be a court of vengeance settling old scores? Should Saddam be tried in Iraq or in an international court? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Diane Orent-Licker, Professor of Law and Director of the War Crimes Research Office at American University in Washington, D.C. Professor, welcome to you.
Thanks.
Who will sit on this Iraqi special tribunal that will try Saddam Hussein?
Well, a statute was adopted last December which established the court that's going to prosecute Saddam Hussein and other defendants, and a decision was made to create an Iraqi court. There had been a lot of debate whether there should be an international court or some kind of combination of a national court and an international court. The Iraqis decided, with encouragement from the United States, to have an Iraqi court. With one caveat, the statute allows but doesn't require foreign judges to be appointed and requires the appointment of foreign advisors. And as Ms. Bernard indicated, there's been quite extensive assistance provided by American prosecutors in particular.
In the past, the United Nations has helped set up tribunals in countries like Sierra Leone, Rwanda, and most famously in the case of Slobodan Milosevic, but no involvement in Iraq.
That's right. There's one big stumbling block, which is that the United Nations will not participate in a trial that could lead to imposition of the death penalty. And so that's presented a barrier to their involvement here. And in addition to that, the United Nations standing among many Iraqis is somewhat ambiguous. There's a lot of resentment about the UN's role in the oil for food scandal and so forth. But really, I think the fundamental point is that Iraqis want this to be their process. They want an Iraqi face on this trial.
And the trial will it rely on the Iraqi legal code?
Well, one of the many challenges that this process faces is that the Iraqi judicial system is very much a work in progress right now. They're reconstituting the legal system after decades of decimation by Saddam Hussein's rule. This court is an innovation. It will prosecute crimes that were not previously part of the Iraqi code. So Iraqi judges are playing a great game of catch-up while they are trying to get ready for some major, major trials.
Saddam Hussein is said to face the death penalty if convicted, but there's still a little bit of confusion as to whether the death penalty is still on the statute books in Iraq, is there not?
The Coalition Provisional Authority suspended the death penalty. I heard a news report today that it had been reinstituted, but I only know that from news reports. I don't know if that's accurate.
What will the prosecutors try to prove, and how will they try to do it?
Well, they've got two main tasks. One is to prove that crimes of extraordinary magnitude were committed, and they will have mountains of evidence to introduce to show that there were indeed crimes committed, the more challenging task will be to prove that the men in the dock were criminally responsible for those abuses. And they have to really connect the crimes to the individuals who were on trial. And there are a number of ways to do that. The most damning kind of evidence is what we think of as a smoking gun, evidence that there were orders by senior officials to carry out these abuses. But in addition to that, it is possible to establish criminal responsibility by proving that someone who was in a position of command and who had a responsibility to make sure that his subordinates behaved properly knew that abuses were taking place and didn't take the proper measures to stop them. And that's, in a sense, a circumstantial kind of proof, but it's a well-established principle in international law. And in effect, what the prosecutor would do is show that massive crimes were committed. Saddam Hussein and others knew about them. The whole world knew about them. How could the leaders of the country not know about them? And they did not take the measures to that were necessary to bring their subordinates under control.
Is there any clarity yet as to whether the charges will include all of Saddam Hussein's, 24 years in power?
Well, they simply can't. And one of the challenges that the prosecutors face is how to be selective. They have been studying the experiences of other war crimes tribunals. They know that you can't prosecute every crime, and what they are trying to do is identify representative crimes that will, in effect, symbolize all of the other crimes that can't be prosecuted. And because they're prosecuting senior officials, in effect, if they convict them of some major crimes, they're convicting them for a wider pattern of abuses. One of the things that they will doubtless want to do is focus on crimes that represent the different categories of victims, Kurds, Shia, other groups who suffered. And in that sense, I think the hope will be that the trial will be a unifying event for Iraqis, that it will be one process that they share in common.
But if that is the case, they're going to have to go a fair way back, aren't they, for instance, to include alleged war crimes relating to the use of chemical weapons against the Kurdish town of Halabja, northern
Iraq.
That's
right. And, you know, there's no doubt that they will go back and prosecute that. That's the one event that everyone knows will be included in the charges.
Do you think that Iraq's fledgling judicial system is up to this challenge?
Well, it's really that's a daunting question. This would be a challenging set of trials for the best functioning legal system in the world. And Iraq's legal system has been destroyed and has to be reconstituted. What the country has to draw on is a very proud heritage of a very long legal tradition that was undermined during decades of Ba'athist rule. And there are some very honorable, fine judges in Iraq. What they haven't had for a long time is the opportunity to practice a fair judicial system and, equally important, to apply this body of law that they're going to be enforcing. It's an extremely sophisticated body of law that's rapidly evolving, and the Iraqi judges are going to be undergoing extensive, very intensive training over the next year.
And very, very briefly, there is a balance to be struck here, isn't there, that the court must be seen to be independent, but has obviously got to rely to a certain extent on international help.
Well, that's quite true. The Iraqis who were involved in setting up this trial recognize that they need international assistance. The challenge is to attract assistance from countries other than the United States. The United States has been providing quite extensive investigative assistance so far, but the defendants will quite certainly charge that the trial and the court has been constituted as to advance an American agenda.
Professor Oren Dlicker, do stay with us. We're talking tonight about the fate of Saddam Hussein. Should he be tried in Iraq or in an international court? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about the fate of Saddam Hussein and what it means to the Iraqi people. Why is it important for Saddam to have an open and fair trial? Do you believe he'll get one, or will this be a court of vengeance, settling old scores? Could this trial set the stage for a new Iraqi legal system? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking to Diane Orentlicker, Professor of Law and Director of the War Crimes Research Office at American University in Washington, D.C. And joining us now from New York is Elise Kepler, Counsel for the International Justice Program for Human Rights Watch. Welcome to you. Do you have any concerns about this forthcoming trial?
Human Rights Watch has real concerns about the tribunal that's been established to try Saddam Hussein and other members of the former Ba'ath Party leadership. We think these trials are essential, that justice for past crimes is essential to bring justice to the victims, but also to help build respect for the rule of law in Iraq. We have serious concerns about the lack of international involvement, the lack of partnership between Iraqis and internationals.
But do you not accept that that partnership, that international involvement, if it is there, has to be quite discreet?
Not at all. We believe, and we have advocated for some time, that the best way to draw on Iraqi experience and also international expertise that's been gained over the years in prosecuting these very, very complex cases, that they should complement each other, that there should be international judges who sit alongside Iraqi judges. There should be international prosecutors who work alongside Iraqi prosecutors.
That's what you'd like to see. But is that going to happen at this late stage?
Well, as Diane pointed out, there is a limited possibility for international judges to be appointed, although that does not appear to be the case right now. And there is no possibility for either investigative judges or prosecutors to be international under the statute as it's written. We urge the new Iraqi government to amend the statute to ensure that there is meaningful international participation to ensure that the trials are credible and legitimate.
So if there isn't this international involvement, what will be the status, in your opinion, of this Iraq special tribunal?
There's a real concern that these trials could degenerate into political show trials. They are very, very complex cases involving massive amounts of evidence. And there's a concern that this is also a situation in which the Iraqi judiciary was severely affected by 40 years of Ba'ath Party rule. And we're very concerned that this won't be a fair, legitimate process.
Professor Orentlicker, do you share those concerns? You seemed to feel earlier that Iraq had an up-and-running legal system, albeit somewhat in disarray at the moment.
Actually, I meant to convey the point that the Iraqi judicial system has a proud tradition, but it's right now a work in progress. It's being reconstituted at the very time that it's undertaking a set of trials that would challenge even a well-functioning judicial system. So there really are some daunting challenges ahead for the Iraqis. They are aware that they need assistance. They're very keenly aware of that. And so I think the question is what form that assistance will come in. And as I indicated earlier, I think one of the issues is whether the assistance is from countries other than the United States. You know, whether rightly or not, a trial that is supported principally by the United States will be seen as a trial that it will have the potential taint of victor's justice, and that would be unhelpful to the larger message that the trial will hopefully send.
Elise Kepler, if this Iraqi special tribunal falls short of your own legal expectations, what is the ideal model? I mean, are there other war crimes tribunals that have been established that you'd like to see enforced in Iraq?
Human Rights Watch has advocated that the better approach in this instance would have been to form a commission of experts to assess the best option to bring justice in Iraq in partnership with the UN. One of the models that could be used is the Special Court for Sierra Leone that, in fact, is a partnership between the United Nations and the people of Sierra Leone and involves a mixture in terms of the bench and staff and prosecutors of local and international staff.
But in the likelihood that that will not happen, what sort of checks and balances would you like to see in the functioning of this Iraqi-dominated special tribunal?
We have real concerns about the setup right now in terms of the statute establishing the tribunal. As Diane mentioned, the death penalty is a possibility here. The CPA did suspend the death penalty, but Iraqi criminal law does permit it. So that's a major concern. The statute does not explicitly prohibit the death penalty. There are also concerns that rights are not protected from the earliest moment in light of how emotionally charged and sensitive these issues are going to be. It's going to be essential to ensure that rights are protected every step of the way. There's also concern that it is not explicitly spelled out that guilt must be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. So these are all concerns within the statute in terms of rights of the accused. Another area of concern is this reliance on Iraqi criminal law, which, as the statute's written, fills in the gaps where the statute does not address an issue. And there's real concerns about the Iraqi Criminal Procedure Code and criminal law in terms of ensuring fairness. One issue in particular is that the Iraqi Criminal Procedure Code allows evidence that may have been produced through coercion if it's corroborated by additional evidence.
Let's take a call from Peter in Westford, Massachusetts. Peter, good evening. What did you want to say?
Hi, good evening. I was pondering the history of Saddam Hussein and his relationship with the United States when we are actually on good terms. And I would imagine he has a lot of interesting and sensitive information that might be embarrassing, if not severely compromising, to the position of the West in the Mideast. And I think I'm surprised that he was actually turned over to the Iraqis to stand trial there and kind of out of the grasp of the Americans. Aren't there potentially, I guess my question for your guests is, aren't there potentially very damaging information that could come out in an open trial of Saddam Hussein and all his crimes in the past?
Diane Orentlecha.
Sure. Julian, this is, I'm afraid, going to have to be my last question because I need to leave. But I think it's quite likely that Saddam Hussein and other defendants will introduce and or attempt to introduce evidence that would be embarrassing to the United States. And there are two principal ways to address that. One is that some of that will be legally irrelevant and can be properly excluded, and some of it may be legally relevant. And if that's the case, of course, these defendants are entitled to present a full defense. And the United States has done some things that it regrets and would find embarrassing. But I don't think we should be terribly afraid of that if it's legally relevant. I don't think it will advance the United States' interest or Iraqis' interest to go through contortions to try to keep that out of court.
Diane Orentlecha, thanks for that, and thanks indeed for being with us this hour. Diane Orentlecha, Professor of Law and Director of the War Crimes Research Office at American University in Washington, D.C. And Lise Kepler, presumably for you, the more open this trial, the better.
Absolutely. We want this trial to be fair and public and to abide by international standards. And if there is evidence that's relevant, then we don't see any reason why it shouldn't be presented.
Let's bring in David Phillips, Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, who's advised the State Department on issues concerning both the Kurds and the Iraqi opposition during Saddam's regime. Welcome, David Phillips. We've been talking about the legal niceties or otherwise of this forthcoming trial, but presumably many Iraqis will have a completely different take on it.
in this instance, I think we need to be wary that perfection not become the enemy of the good. It's absolutely clear that the Iraqi judicial system has a long way to go, but for the interim government to demonstrate to the Iraqi people that it has some capabilities, it needs to take the lead in this trial. It's important that Iraqis, as accusers, face Saddam Hussein. If they do that and the interim government is able to manage the procedure, it will go a long way to inspiring more confidence among the Iraqi people that they're actually involved in a credible political process that will culminate with the departure of coalition forces.
You're suggesting then that Iraqi expectations of this trial might be less than those of the international community?
Significantly less. I mean, keep in mind that the cultural context and the fact that right now what Iraqis want is they want justice served to Saddam, and they want the U.S. and multinational force out of the country. If the interim government is able to get some traction and make progress in the trial, it's going to inspire confidence among Iraqis, and it's going to create conditions that allow more and more Iraqis to peel away the foreign fighters and take on a constructive role in the domestic political process.
So you're suggesting that Iraqis want to see a thorough airing of the human rights abuses of which Saddam Hussein is accused.
And this isn't just about the trial. It's about also reconciliation. If there's a thorough airing, it's going to allow the Iraqi people to deal with the past and then move on in building a brighter future. It's clear that there have been terrible atrocities that Saddam has committed. It's also clear that the Iraqi people want that tragic period in their history to end, and that they're prepared to give the interim government the benefit of the doubt for a while. We need a process that allows the Iraqi people to move forward and to advance the overall goal of reconciliation among the country's different ethnic and religious groups.
Isn't there another way of doing that, though, perhaps by setting up a truth and reconciliation commission along the South African model?
There is conversation that Iraqis have underway about setting up a truth and reconciliation process. And truth and reconciliation is never a surrogate for justice. And I'm not suggesting by any means that a trial of Saddam deviate dramatically from international standards. I liked Lise Kepler's suggestion of trying to draw some inspiration from the hybrid model in Sierra Leone. But a truth and reconciliation process isn't exclusive to a trial that also advances the goal of reconciliation. Right now, the Iraqi people are looking to start a period of healing. They can do that through the administration of justice, as well as a national dialogue on what kind of future they want to build together.
Elise Kepler, in these kinds of situations, isn't there a need to strike a balance between the need for justice and the need for reconciliation?
Reconciliation is important, and justice is also important, and one cannot be justice can't be sacrificed in the name of reconciliation. In terms of kind of advancing the credibility of the Iraqi government through this process, a point on that, I mean, we'll be watching very, very closely to see over these next several days and proceedings to see exactly what kinds of fair trial guarantees Saddam Hussein and the other high-value detainees will be receiving. Will they receive access to counsel? Will they receive access to family? What kinds of facilities are they going to be given to mount their defense? We'll need to see just what kinds of fair trial standards are going to be implemented.
I mean, it could be said that you seem a little bit more concerned for the defendants maybe than for the victims.
Absolutely not. We feel, though, that it's essential to respect the rights of the accused. This is important to building respect for the rule of law in Iraq and is part and parcel of bringing justice to the victims. Justice has to be done and be seen to be done.
Let me just add a point there, which is that if justice is seen to be done, that will also advance the goal of reconciliation. So you can't sacrifice prosecution and justice in lieu of some reconciliation process that doesn't deliver what the people want, which is to see those who committed atrocities in the dock and punished.
David Phillips, your long-running contacts with the Iraqi opposition and the alleged human rights abuses by Saddam Hussein, where does the prosecution, in your opinion, have the strongest case?
There was a clear command and control structure that ties Saddam Hussein to his cousin, Ali Hassan Masjid, otherwise known as Chemical Ali. He was responsible for the Anfal campaign in northern Iraq that used chemical weapons against the Kurds in Halabja and in 200 other towns and villages. The campaign also eradicated several thousand villages, killed tens of thousands of Kurds, and displaced hundreds of thousands. I don't think that there's going to be a problem linking Saddam to the trigger command. Also, after the uprising in 1991, the crackdown against the Arab Shia involved close confidants of Saddam Hussein. We know that there are at least 30,000 bodies in mass graves, such as the one in Hilla. It won't be hard to link Saddam Hussein to atrocities that have been committed against the Arab Shia and Iraqi Kurds.
Elise Kepler, isn't there a broader point here, though, that whatever the nature of this tribunal, whatever the checks and the balances, the world has very largely passed judgment on Saddam Hussein already?
Regardless of what public opinion may be, it's absolutely essential that the crimes he's accused of committing are proven in a court of law, proven beyond a reasonable doubt. That's essential to ensure that the process is legitimate and credible.
Let me add that that needs to be an Iraqi court of law, because right now Iraqis want to be able to take control of their future. If they can't organize a process that holds Saddam accountable, there's very little likelihood that they're going to be able to deal with the other myriad challenges that the country's facing.
David Phillips, do stay with us, and you too, Elise Kepler. We're discussing the fate of Saddam Hussein, his custody, his trial, and what it means to the Iraqi people. Why is it important for Saddam to have an open and fair trial? Do you believe he'll get one? Or will this be a court of vengeance settling old scores? Could this trial set the stage for a fair and open Iraqi judicial system? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about the fate of Saddam Hussein, his custody, his trial, and what it means to his victims and the future of Iraq. Why is it important for Saddam to have an open and fair trial? Do you believe he'll get one? Or will this be a court of vengeance settling old scores? Should he face the death penalty if convicted? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm speaking to Elise Kepler, counsel for the International Justice Programme at Human Rights Watch, and to David Phillips, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, who's advised the State Department on issues concerning both the Kurds and the Iraqi opposition during Saddam's regime. And joining us now from New York City is Ivan Fisher. He's a defense attorney who specializes in criminal litigation. Welcome, Ivan Fisher.
Hello.
Saddam's wife has assembled a team of 20 foreign lawyers to represent him. I know you're not one of them, but what sort of defense could you mount for Saddam Hussein?
Well, I think I'd want to put the conduct at issue into context. There have been lots of schools that have been opened and lots of teachers that have been paid and lots of hospitals that have been built and staffed and all kinds of good things that could be shown to have been accomplished during Saddam's reign. And I'd want to get that context out. I'd also like to make the point that one doesn't use as a standard for a sovereign leader the same set of rules you'd apply to a non-sovereign individual. Different rules apply. Surely the prisoner abuse at Abu Ghraib has not been placed at the hands of George Bush, nor is the torture of the Viet Cong during the Vietnamese War have we held our president accountable for conduct like that, or My Lai, or any of the atrocities that have occurred by Americans acting in behalf of their country.
But Mr. Fisher, it seems you might have common cause with a lot of commentators. Were you, as a defense lawyer for Saddam Hussein, to challenge the very legality of this court?
Well, I'd wonder how fair a trial Saddam Hussein could get under these circumstances. We have a government selected in fact by the American authority, and it has chosen this tribunal. The United States has a very keen interest in blackening Saddam Hussein. They haven't found weapons of mass destruction, but they have found Saddam Hussein. So the bigger and worse he is, the more justified this apparently unjustifiable war becomes.
And some of those interventions are just absurd. Let me jump in there.
Right.
I can't believe that because somebody builds a few hospitals and schools that you excuse massive crimes against humanity and genocide.
I'm not talking about excusing and putting a context to the conduct.
Okay, before we go further down this hypothetical road, let's bring in Joe calling from Boston, Massachusetts. And he's got a bigger question. Joe?
Hi. Hi, how are you? Thank you for taking my call.
Okay, go ahead.
I have a question. Why is it so important to give Saddam Hussein all the benefits of a meticulously thought-out concept of justice when he did not give that to all his victims? Well, what is fair in that equation? Tell me, please.
Elise Kepler, tell us.
In fact, it's precisely for that reason that in order to not blur the distinction between the regime, Saddam Hussein's regime, and a post-Saddam Hussein Iraq, to build respect for the rule of law, to ensure that international standards are complied with, it is essential that this be a scrupulously fair process.
Let's hear from Jay in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And Jay, I think that you're thinking along similar lines.
Yes. Basically, my question was, it is interesting to see Western experts talking about an Iraqi problem. And it's kind of sad to see a prescription almost by Western experts telling Iraqis what to do. I think there's kind of an interesting situation there. And I don't know how many of your experts know that the Hammurabi Code was actually made in Iraq. There are tremendous Iraqi traditions that go into human rights and so on. And we're kind of speaking about the Iraqi legal situation as if it's in a vacuum. The other thing is that it's certainly justice. Who's going to prosecute the war crimes in Tibet and Siberia and the gulags, which are far, far worse crimes than what we're talking about here? It's ultimately, it is the victor that is able to prosecute any crimes. And if the perpetrator is too powerful, nothing happens.
Ivan Fisher, presumably that's something that you would pick up on in conducting a hypothetical defense of Saddam Hussein.
Well, the question becomes whether or not it's appropriate to prosecute a sovereign for conduct committed as a sovereign. It may have been very harsh measures taken by Saddam Hussein, and maybe terrible things, but in running a country, sometimes very difficult measures need to be taken in order to preserve order. That would be a position I think Saddam Hussein might be taking at his hearing and trial.
David Phillips, I mean, is it the case that there is no other outcome to this trial that would satisfy
Iraqis than a guilty verdict?
And let me just address the previous point as well. We've learned nothing from the 20th century if we allow tyrants and dictators to hide behind claims of sovereignty and commit gross human rights violations against their citizens. As far as what Iraqis are looking for, they lived under Saddam's tyranny for 35 years. They know full well what conditions were like in Iraq. They're looking for a judicial process which is fair, which meets international standards, and which ultimately holds Saddam accountable for the crimes that everyone knows full well he committed.
And you see, the role of the international community at the moment is not dictating how Iraqis should do this, but giving them a helping hand.
The international community needs to give the Iraqi government a helping hand with the trial and with the overall political transition. One of the results of the handover a couple of days ago was that Iraq is now formally reintegrated into the international community. Diplomatic letters are being exchanged and envoys are being sent back and forth. It's important that Iraq continue that process, that it abide by international standards, and if it's going to be welcomed back into the community of nations, it needs to be able to set up a judicial procedure which meets the needs of the Iraqi people as well as complies with international standards of jurisprudence.
Elise Kepler, can I put that same point to you, that there is going to be no outcome to this trial that will satisfy most Iraqis other than a guilty verdict?
I think Iraqis want to see justice done, that there's a commitment to that, and that the process, the trials will take place, and hopefully the evidence will make the case.
But why should he be accorded the kind of legal process that he never accorded to his victims?
And Elise made that point clearly before. If you accord Saddam a legal process that he never accorded his victims, that distinguishes the new government from the old government. Iraqis are looking to turn the page. This trial is an important opportunity for them to do so and to meet international standards so they can demonstrate to themselves and to the world community that they're moving forward.
Elise Kepler, will human rights want to be represented at this trial?
Human Rights Watch?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, could you explain a little further?
I mean, would you want to be there in an observer capacity at this trial?
We'll be watching very, very closely how these proceedings unfold. It will be very important to see kind of whether or not there will be fair trial guarantees.
Elise Kepler, many thanks for being with us. Elise Kepler, counsel for the International Justice Program at Human Rights Watch. Thanks to you too, David Phillips, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, who's advised the State Department on issues concerning both the Kurds and the Iraqi opposition during Saddam's regime. And thanks to you in New York City, Ivan Fisher, a defense attorney who specializes in criminal litigation. Continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, the U.S. considers moving hundreds of detainees out of Guantanamo Bay. This is On Point. Yesterday, the Supreme Court ruled that military prisoners held at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba could challenge their detention in U.S. courts. Now, senior Bush administration officials are considering moving hundreds of detainees from Cuba to prisons within the U.S. John Hendren, a staff writer in Washington for the Los Angeles Times, is covering the story. I asked him earlier whether the Bush administration was caught by surprise by the Supreme Court ruling.
Absolutely. And that's evidenced by a Justice Department memo that I had a look at in which they had two different scenarios for winning or partially winning these Supreme Court cases. They did not have a scenario at all for the kind of major setbacks that actually occurred this week.
And what are the options now for enabling prisoners at Guantanamo Bay to receive legal counsel?
Well, they can either move all of them to a U.S. military prison somewhere here in the United States and hope that the court system will allow them to process all of these cases in the same place, because now they have to give each of them some kind of review akin to the habeas corpus hearings in which the government tells them why they're being held. Or they could set up some kind of makeshift court on Guantanamo. Or a third option they're also considering is having Congress declare one district in the United States where all these cases could go. By doing that, they avoid having cases heard all over the United States and having to ship 595 Guantanamo detainees throughout the country.
But it is nonetheless going to be a massive logistical task moving all these people.
Absolutely. Even if they keep them in Guantanamo, which is sort of the lowest impact option, they still have to set up some kind of a court system there.
Where do you think the prisoners will be moved, and why would those places be chosen?
Well, I think the administration would like to see, if they are going to move them, they'd like to move them to some kind of conservative judicial district. That basically means they're going to keep them off the West Coast, where the liberal 9th district is housed. It could be someplace where they've got a military facility, such as Fort Leavenworth in Kansas. It could also be Washington, D.C., for that matter. It's difficult to say at this point where they might be. There's also a brig, naval brig, in Charleston, South Carolina.
And this comes as a more general reorganization of Guantanamo is currently under consideration.
That's right. And plans for that are still gelling. It's the topic of conversations. Yesterday, there was a deputy meeting among senior administration officials from a number of different agencies. And one of the things that they discussed was reorganizing Guantanamo so that detainees were sort of arranged by their risk level and segregated.
If the Guantanamo detainees are moved to the United States, what would be the judicial process?
Well, they would likely have to receive either a full hearing in which they demanded a writ of habeas corpus, in other words, the justification for being held, or it is conceivable that there would be some kind of lesser military proceeding. The Supreme Court really left that question open, and it's unclear what's going to happen. There may be lawsuits that determine that.
I mean, the Bush administration has contended up until now that it could be trusted to offer detainees full and fair justice. That contention yet further undermined?
Yes, not just by the Supreme Court decision, but I think the Abu Ghraib prison scandal, while it wasn't raised specifically in these Supreme Court decisions, it's really cast a shadow over the whole procedure. The government can no longer with a straight face say we can be trusted to take care of people.
John Hendren, many thanks.
Thank you.
John Hendren, a staff writer for the Los Angeles Times, spoke to me earlier from Washington. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Amada, Jane Manners, Tamar Morad, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Julian Marshall, standing in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.